And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is October the 18th. 291st day of the year. 74 days remain till the year is over with. It's interesting to note, we even have liberals protesting now. They don't know what they're protesting about, but by God, they're out there trying to lead the pack so they can be considered activists. Well, on this day in history in the year 33, heartbroken by the deaths of her sons Nero and Drusus, and banished to the island of Pandateria by Tiberius, Agrippina the Elder dies of self-inflicted starvation. In 320, Pappus of Alexandria, Greek philosopher, observes an eclipse of the sun and writes a commentary on the great astronomer, Almagest. 614, King Clothar II promulgates the Edict of Paris, sort of Frankish Magna Carta that defends the rights of the Frankish nobles while it excludes Jews from all civil employment in the Frankish kingdom. I've never really understood, what is this massive anti-Jewish feeling and where did it come from? In 629, Dagobert is crowned king of the Franks. In 1009, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Christian church in Jerusalem, was completely destroyed by the Fatimid Caliph, Al-Hakim B. Amir Allah, who hacks the church foundation down to bedrock. 1016, the Danes defeat the English in the Battle of Assumden. 1081, the Normans defeat the Byzantine Empire in the Battle of Dyrrhachium. 1356, Basel earthquake. Most significant historic seismological event north of the Alps destroys the town of Basel in Switzerland. 1540, Spanish conquistador Hernando de Soto's forces destroy the fortified town of Mabiblia in present-day Alabama, killing Tuscaloosa. Now, he was a paramount chief of a Mississippian chiefdom in what's now the state of Alabama. His people are possibly ancestors to the several southern Native American confederacies, such as the Choctaw and the Creek. And the city of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, is named after him. Now, of course, you're going to see people protesting that before we get done. Folks have absolutely lost their tiny little minds. They've got to have something to protest about, or they're just not happy. 1561 in Japan, the fourth battle of Kawankahima is fought between the forces of Yusugi Kenshin and Takeda Shingen, resulting in a draw. 1565, ships belonging to the Matsura clan of Japan failed to capture the Portuguese trading carrack in the Battle of Fukuda Bay. That's the first recorded naval battle between Japan and the West. 1599, Michael the Brave, Prince of Wallachia, defeats the army of Andrew Bathory in the Battle of Salimbar, leading to the first recorded unification of the Romanian people. Andrew Bathory was related to the Bloody Countess, as she's called, Elizabeth Bathory. 1648, Boston Shoemakers formed the first American labor organization. 1748, signing of the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle ends the War of the Austrian Succession. 1775, African-American poet Phyllis Wheatley is freed from slavery. Also that same year, American Revolutionary War, the burning of Falmouth, which is now Portland, Maine, took place on this date. 1779, American Revolutionary War, the Franco-American siege of Savannah is lifted. In Now, this is also known as the Second Battle of Savannah. The year before, the city of Savannah had been captured by a British Expeditionary Corps under Lieutenant Colonel Archibald Campbell. And the siege itself consisted of a joint Franco-American attempt to retake Savannah. On October 9th, a major assault against the British siege works failed. And during the attack, Polish nobleman Count Casimir Pulaski, leading the combined cavalry forces on the American side, was mortally wounded. With the failure of this joint attack, the siege was abandoned and the British remained in control of Savannah until 1782, which was close to the end of the war. 1779, more than 500 recruits from Santo Domingo, the French colony that later became Haiti, under the overall command of French nobleman Charles Hector, Comte d'Estaing, fought alongside American colonial troops against the British Army during the siege of Savannah. That was one of the most significant foreign contributions to the American Revolutionary War. In 1797, a Treaty of Campo Formio signed between France and Austria. 1851, Herman Melville's Moby Dick is first published as The Whale by Richard Bentley of London. 1860, the Second Opium War finally ends at the Convention of Peking with the ratification of the Treaty of Tientsin, which was an unequal treaty. 1867, the U.S. takes possession of Alaska after purchasing it from Russia for $7.2 million. This is celebrated annually in the state as Alaska Day. 1898, the U.S. takes possession of Puerto Rico from Spain. And on this day in 1900, Count Bernhard von Bülow becomes Chancellor of Germany. 1912, the First Balkan War. King Peter I of Serbia issues a declaration to the Serbian people as his country joins the war. 1914, the Schoenstatt Apostolic Movement is founded in Germany. 1921, the Crimean Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic is formed as part of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic. 1922, the British Broadcasting Company, later known as the British Broadcasting Corporation, is founded by a consortium to establish a nationwide network of radio transmitters to provide a national broadcasting service. 1929, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council overrules the Supreme Court of Canada in Edwards versus Canada when it declares women are considered persons under Canadian law. I wonder what they were before that. 1944. World War II, Soviet Union begins the liberation of Czechoslovakia from Nazi Germany. Also in 1944, the state funeral of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel takes place in Germany. He was actually ordered to commit suicide by Hitler, or they would take it out on his family. In 1945, USSR's nuclear program sees plans for the U.S. plutonium bomb from Klaus Fuchs at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. 1945, a group of the Venezuelan armed forces led by Mario Vargas, Marcos Perez Jimenez, and Carlos Delgado Chabald stages a coup against the president, Cesáreas Medina Anguita, who is overthrown by the end of the day. 1945, Argentine military officer and politician Juan Perón marries actress Eva Duarte. 1954, Texas Instruments announces the first transistor radio. 1960, I used to have one that didn't run on batteries, but if you hooked the clip to, say, a wire fence, it worked beautifully. 1963, Felicity, a black and white female Persian stray cat, becomes the first cat launched into space. 1967, a Soviet probe, Venera 4, reaches Venus and becomes the first spacecraft to measure the atmosphere of another planet. 1977, German Autumn, set of events revolving around the kidnapping of Hans Martin Schaller and the hijacking of a Lufthansa flight by the Red Army faction comes to an end when Schaller is murdered and various RSF members allegedly commit suicide. 1979, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, begins allowing people to have home satellite earth stations without a federal government license. In 1991, the Supreme Court of Azerbaijan adopts a Declaration of Independence from the Soviet Union. 2003, Bolivian gas conflict. Bolivian President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada is forced to resign and leave Bolivia. 2007, Karachi bombing. Suicide attack on a motorcade carrying former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto kills 139 and wounds 450 more. Bhutto herself is not even scratched. 2019, NASA astronauts Jessica Meir and Christina Koch take part in the first all-female spacewalk when they venture out of the International Space Station to replace a power controller. 2019, riots in Chile's capital, Santiago, escalate into open battles with attacks reported at nearly all the city's 164 metro stations. President Sebastián Piñera announces a 15-day state of emergency in the capital. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances. In Alaska, we have Alaska Day. Christian Feast Day, Justice of Beauvais, Luke the Evangelist, Peter of Alcantara. Independence Day in Azerbaijan celebrates independence of Azerbaijan from the Soviet Union in 1991. In Croatia, it's Necktie Day. In Canada, it's Person's Day. And internationally, it is World Menopause Day. Let's see what else we got. In 1685, French King Louis XIV, also known as the Sun King, revokes the Edict of Nantes, canceling rights of French Protestants. 1931, on this date, American gangster Al Capone is convicted of tax evasion. 1962, James Watson of the U.S., Francis Crick of the U.K., and Maurice Wilkins of the U.K. win the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their work in determining the structure of the DNA. On October 18, 1776, in a bar decorated with bird tail in Elmsford, New York, customer requests a glassful of those cocktails from bartender Betsy Flanagan. Thus was created the cocktail. Famous birthdays, Pierre Trudeau, born on this date in 1919. Chuck Berry, born in 1926. George C. Scott Patton, born in 1927. Lee Harvey Oswald, born in 1939. And Martina Navratilova, born in 64 years ago. And Jean-Claude Van Damme was born on this date 60 years ago. In 1869, Sardinia King Victor Emmanuel II, who was 49 at the time, married his mistress, Roosevelt Versalana, who was 36. They married in Italy. 1926, Communist Revolutionary Leader Ho Chi Minh wedded midwife Xing Zhongming in Guangzhou. She was 21, he was 36. And in 2000, Demi Moore, who was 37, divorced actor Bruce Willis, who was 45. She claimed irreconcilable differences. They'd been married 13 years. Thomas Edison died on this date in 1931. Bess Truman died on this date in 1982. Andreas Bada of the Bada Meinhof gang died on this date in 1977. Alrighty. Let's see what else there might be. In 2007, Benazir Bhutto returned to Pakistan. She was former prime minister and a daughter of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who was the ninth prime minister of Pakistan. She lived in London and Dubai for 8 years in self-imposed exile, but she came back. 2 months after coming back, she was assassinated in a bombing while campaigning for the forthcoming election. 1998, the Jesse Pipeline explosion in Nigeria kills over 200. It was owned by the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, just outside the city of Lagos. The fire that resulted from the bombing raged for 6 days. Okay. Let's see what else there might be. This is also Chocolate Cupcake Day. You have to go out and find me some of those. It's also No Beard Day. In 1988, the American sitcom Roseanne, starring Roseanne Barr, premiered on ABC. She was thrown off of it because she had a political opinion. In 1961, the musical West Side Story was released in American theaters. In 1854, the Ostend Manifesto was declared. In it, three U.S. diplomats communicating to Secretary of State William Marcy advocated the U.S. seize Cuba from Spain. 1469, Isabella I, Queen of Castile, married Ferdinand II, the King of Aragon. 'Cause on this day in 1781, Lord Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown. Jonathan Swift, the author and clergyman, actually he died tomorrow in Dublin. In 1914, World War I, First Battle of Ypres, began in western Flanders. Allies and Germans settled into the trench warfare that would characterize the remainder of the war on the Western Front. On this day in 1897, George Pullman, inventor of the Pullman sleeping car, died. This day in 1864, Confederate soldiers based in Canada crossed into St. Albans, Vermont and robbed three banks They wanted to agitate the Union during the Civil War. On this day in 1812, Napoleon began his retreat from Russia. On this day in 2014, Dominican-born American fashion designer Oscar de la Renta, whose work blended European luxury with American ease, died in Connecticut. 2011, Libyan de facto leader Muammar Gaddafi is killed by rebel forces following a revolt that got international military assistance. Plane carrying the southern rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd crashed in Gillsburg, Mississippi. Killed singer Ronnie Van Zant, guitarist Steve Gaines, among others. In 1973, during the Watergate investigation, President Nixon ordered Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox fired. That resulted in the resignations of Attorney General Elliot Richardson and Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus, both of whom refused to carry out the order. This situation became known as the Saturday Night Massacre of Justice Department officials. All righty, anything else? 1740, Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI died. His death began the War of Austrian Succession. threats and plots and assassination attempts on various U.S. presidents. You know, in the Kennedy assassination, you know, even today we call Oswald the president's assassin, but he was never charged, and there's absolutely no proof he did anything. In fact, there's evidence that would tend to exonerate him. You know, blame for the poor protection of Kennedy. There was enough of it to go around. Despite warnings of violence in Dallas, Kennedy refused to allow the Secret Service agents to ride on the running board of his limo. Also refused to allow the dome to be put on the convertible. And, of course, other government agencies were said to have been culpable. The FBI failed to keep Oswald under observation during the presidential visit, even though there was a file on Oswald that traced his movements back to the time he spent in the Soviet Union. 2 weeks before the assassination, Oswald supposed to have marched into the local FBI office and created a scene, complaining about the harassment his wife was receiving from FBI agents. They were trying to keep track of Oswald himself, but they were harassing his wife, so he said. And of course, Kennedy's assassination had a terrible impact on agents and their families. Agent Clint Hill, who rescued Jackie as she climbed onto the trunk of the limo, went into a downward spiral of depression and alcoholism. 1990, when he tried to make sense of his role in the assassination, he visited Dealey Plaza. He said, "I walked that plaza for a long time, looking back and forth and up and down at every angle, thinking how could this have been avoided? What could he have done differently?" He finally came to the conclusion, because of everything that happened that day, that every advantage had gone to the assassin. And the Secret Service and FBI had no advantages. And he finally realized, based on the conditions, there was nothing he could have done.
Years later, during the 80-year-old Hill said, "I wasn't thinking of my own safety. I thought I have to shield him." In that same instant, blood and brain matter and bone fragments exploded from the back of the president's head. The impact was like the sound of something hard hitting a melon that shattered on the concrete. The president was killed on my duty. And while that may well be true, you have to wonder. Even assuming Oswald was the assassin, how could he have carried it out? He wasn't that good a shot. And the weapon he was supposedly using was an antique when it first came out. Now, there are a number of theories about Oswald's motivation for assassinating Kennedy. 1980s, Gene Davison's Oswald's Game gave readers a logical explanation. The assassin was a wannabe revolutionary who worshipped Cuba's Marxist dictator Castro. According to Davison, Oswald acted out of a distorted sense of political idealism. And in Vincent Bugliosi's Reclaiming History, examined every theory and every conspiracy claim. The former Los Angeles lawyer became famous for his prosecution of Charles Manson, took the debate about conspiracy allegations a step further. He provided a devastating, no-nonsense approach to the ridiculous assassination scenarios brought up by conspiracy authors, all of whom deliberately skewed the evidence in this case. 50 years after Kennedy's assassination, there's not been any credible evidence showing JFK's assassination was the result of a conspiracy, even though the House committee issued an edict that it was a conspiracy. Sophisticated reenactments of the assassination using state-of-the-art technology have shown that three shots were fired off behind and from the direction of the sixth floor of the school book depository. The rifle and the pistol Oswald supposedly used were traced to Oswald. Spectrographic analysis of photographs purported to show gunmen on the grassy knoll only showed lights in the shadows. The single bullet theory, the magic bullet, neutron activation analysis of the fragments that supposedly came from that bullet confirmed that Oswald could have fired the three shots. You know, there's a lot of evidence that links him to it, but there's no definitive evidence. Now, the next president to face an assassination attempt was Lyndon, I'm going to be King, Johnson. He'd been seated in his car traveling behind JFK's limo in Dallas. He was the only president in American history to witness his predecessor's murder. At the age of 13, he'd boasted to his school friends he's going to be president someday. He went on to become a Texas congressman, U.S. Senate majority leader, and vice president after losing his bid for the Democratic nomination in 1960. When he was Senate leader, he told colleagues he was destined for the presidency. But frightened of failure, he waited too long to announce his candidacy for the 1960 Democratic Party presidential nomination. That gave JFK a head start. When he accepted the vice presidential nomination, he told his friends, one in four presidents had died in office, and he had a good chance of becoming a president someday. Here's his VP sulking and complaining he had nothing to do. In fact, the vice presidency was said to have fueled his extreme inferiority complex. Many of Kennedy's White House staff held Johnson in contempt, which added to Johnson's feeling of inferiority. Behind his back, Kennedy's aides poked fun at Johnson for his clumsy, unsophisticated ways. Bobby Kennedy was especially contemptuous of Johnson, who he saw as mean, vicious, and bitter, which was probably true. JFK marginalized Johnson, meeting with him only rarely. Evidence suggests Kennedy is ready to drop Johnson in the 1964 presidential election. And Johnson was also being investigated for making a fortune from selling political favors. Well, as Johnson rode through Dallas behind the president's Secret Service follow-up car, he appeared to be staring into the political abyss. But with what was said to have been 3 bullets fired that day. His future changed. As VP, Johnston was difficult for many Secret Service agents to deal with. According to aircraft steward Jack Woodward, when Johnston was VP, he didn't like the Secret Service and he'd try and sneak away from them. He said, "I made the round the world tour with Mr. Johnston. I did the same things for him I do for the president. Laid out his clothing and so forth. And let me tell you, he was a very difficult man." Woodward said he didn't cotton to Johnston because of his Bullen and China Shop type of carrying zone. Johnston wanted everybody to know who he was and what he was. He'd be getting into conferences with his staff and so forth, and if somebody disagreed with him, the first thing that came off was his shoe that he would pound the table with the heel. A la Nikita Khrushchev. On the day of Kennedy's assassination, as Oswald opened fire at Agent Rufus Youngblood, bolted over the front seat of the VP's car and threw his body on top of Johnston. Johnston later said Youngblood's quick reaction was as brave an act as I've ever seen performed. When a man without a moment's notice or hesitation puts himself between you and a possible assassin's bullet, you know you've seen courage, and you don't forget it. Youngblood went on to receive the Treasury Department's Exceptional Service Award for his bravery, and Johnston had him appointed Deputy Director under the Secret Service Chief James Rowley. 5 years later, Johnston said he'd never forget that day in Dallas when a great big husky roughneck from Georgia threw 185 pounds of human weight on me and said, "Down." He said there wasn't any place I could go but down because he's on top of me. His wife is being offered to protect mine. Well, despite Johnston's admiration for this agent, he turned to Jackie Kennedy, senior agent, for advice about his security arrangements. He frequently called Agent Clint Hill, telling him he'd been having premonitions he'd be assassinated. In a series of late-night conversations, Hill reassured Johnston he'd be there when he was needed. After Kennedy's assassination, the Secret Service presidential detail was integrated with Johnston's. Gerald Blaine said the effect was not in any way seamless, and the cohesiveness of the Kennedy detail unraveled like a slow death. Blaine said the joking and the camaraderie between the agents disappeared instantly. Part of the problem was that Johnston's agents were conscious of the fact JFK's detail had lost the president, and they began to triple and quadruple check the new president's security arrangements. Director of the White House Military Office, Bill Gulley, said the Secret Service kept Johnston scared to death. They never missed an opportunity to frighten the president. Before he went anywhere, they'd tell him all the possible assailants that were last known to be in the area, or that could be coming to the area, or that they'd lost sight of and might possibly turn up in the area. And Gulley also said Johnston didn't respect his agents. He once said to someone with him, "Look at those bastards back there. They're supposed to be Secret Service, but they look like a bunch of goddamn Mexican generals." Dennis McCarthy, who served on the White House detail during the last 2 years of Johnston's presidency, he said the president treated agents who accompanied him on visits to Texas Ranch as though they were hired help. Yeah, he often ordered them to carry out menial jobs like washing his car. Agents acceded to LBJ's wish for the pool to be cleaned at his ranch, but drew the line at washing the car. Most of Johnston's detail didn't like him either. Some to the point they looked for ways to get even. When the president ordered one of his agents to walk his dog during a rainy day at the Texas ranch, the agents took the muddy dog to the president's bedroom and left it there. Next day, LBJ ordered that his dogs be cleaned up before they were returned to him. The agents who'd been on LBJ's vice presidential detail advised their peers to stand up to him or he'd bowl you over. One agent took that advice. Once when he was seated in the front seat of the presidential limousine, he was struck by a newspaper wielding Johnston. When the agent asked the president to stop hitting him, LBJ ignored him. The agents ordered the driver to stop the car, open the back door, and punch the president in the eye. Now, Johnston didn't know the names of any of his agents except for 3 or 4 of the most senior members of detail. He'd simply shout Secret Service, followed by some type of demand. And he sometimes got violent with the agents, pushing them, and according to one former agent, Tony Sherman, on one occasion even knocking the agent off a motorcycle. And Johnson, who was known for his quick temper, would frequently swear at his protectors. You never knew what kind of mood he was going to be in and what might suddenly set him off in a tirade. McCarthy said Johnson was generally a royal pain to deal with. Rufus Youngblood took a more balanced view of Johnson, saying LBJ had a streak of impetuosity. He could chew out in a way that would have been the envy of a seasoned Marine drill instructor, but when the mood was on him, he'd be the most sentimental of men, sometimes almost to the point of being maudlin. And if you couldn't adjust to this pendulum action, it would be unusually difficult working with him. Johnson wasn't altogether insensitive about the demands he made on his detail. In 1966, he invited 12 agents and their wives to a pre-Christmas barbecue at his ranch. Group had a tour of his ranch, and each wife received a gift of an oak tree picture autographed by the president. Shortly before he left the presidency, during a ceremony at the White House to honor James Riley for his distinguished service, Johnson acknowledged he'd been less than civil with some of his agents. He said, "A lot of things you had to live with through me. If I could rewrite them, I'd change a lot of them. I spent more miles telling you what you did wrong than what you did right. But Lucy, Linda, and Ms. Johnson remind me every day of how blessed you've been to..." Excuse me. "How blessed you've been to them." Strangely, one of the most serious threats to Johnson's life came not from a would-be assassin, but from one of his own agents. The night after Kennedy's assassination, Gerald Blaine was assigned to protect Johnson's two-story house in Washington when he heard the sound of somebody approaching, prompting him to pick up a Thompson submachine gun. He expected the sounds to retreat with the loud sound of the gun activating, but they kept coming closer. So Blaine put his finger firmly on the trigger. Next instant, he saw the new president of the U.S. round the corner, and Blaine had the gun pointed directly at him. Johnson's face went completely white, Blaine later said. The agent said that a split second later he'd have pulled the trigger. So, within 2 days, we came close to losing a second president. Now, Johnson was a difficult president to protect because he was a chance taker, had an impulsive personality, according to White House journalist Merriman Smith. Smith said Johnson frequently gave his agents a hard time about their presence in friendly crowds. According to Hubert Humphrey, LBJ plunged into the crowd because it's good politics, and most important, it makes you feel good. Johnson told his agents, in plain terms, he didn't want them interfering by getting between him and the crowds at airports or political rallies. Accordingly, agents had to work behind him or at his side, and the agents were annoyed at the way Johnson would become angry if an agent stepped in front of him to hold the crowds back. According to Time magazine, Johnson's agents tended to be tenser and more belligerent, sometimes silencing hecklers with flying tackles. Former President Truman voiced his disapproval of Johnson's impetuousness. Truman was aware the president had recently rode in an open car in Pittsburgh for the first time since JFK's assassination, been surrounded by crowds on a visit to a poverty-stricken area in Appalachia. Truman told reporters, "The Secret Service used to give me hell for taking chances." During the presidential election campaign 6 months later, the Secret Service acknowledged the president's life couldn't be adequately protected if Johnson failed to obey Secret Service rules designed to protect him. And it wasn't only Johnson's campaigning technique to concerned agents, but also the way he'd be oblivious to the risk he took in open areas. While campaigning in El Paso, Texas in the summer of 64, Johnson left his bulletproof car 10 times to shake hands with crowds in the streets. In Providence, Rhode Island, in September 64, he stood on top of his car to address a crowd. And during the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, he frequently left himself open to an assassin's bullet, especially during his birthday celebration when he stood on a balcony in the convention hall in bright lights while a firework display complicated security issues. And Johnson's behavior in his Texas ranch also created difficulties for his detail. He took every opportunity to leave his agents behind as he jumped in his car and sped off around the ranch. In December of 63, he made his first visit to the ranch as president, left his airplane and jumped into a car with a friend, A.W. Marsden, to go deer hunting. The men eluded the Secret Service as agents rushed to their vehicles in hasty pursuit. As time passed, agents became accustomed to Johnson's routine of taking off with visitors at speeds of up to 90 miles an hour. On one occasion, LBJ told his agents he's going to shoot out a tire if agents got too close to his car. And there was little the Secret Service could do to prevent the president from trying to elude agents. There's no discussion more futile than the public dialogue that invariably follows threats to the life of a president, according to Johnson's press secretary, George Reedy. It really doesn't matter what anybody says. There's only one man who can do anything about presidential assassination. That's the president himself. Well, of all the people that should never have been president, I suspect LBJ was probably close to the top of the list. You know, JFK's assassination prompted the Secret Service to double the number of agents to about 650 and install computers. Most importantly, the agents began to receive on a systematic basis thousands of reports from Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the Department of State, the Post Office, Immigration and Naturalization, and state and local police departments. By doing so, the number of pieces of information Secret Service received increased from 800 a year to over 20,000. In November 64, the special agent in charge of the Protective Research Section of the Secret Service, Robert Book, received 400 persons who revealed that 400 people were regarded by the Secret Service as definite risk to any president. He said in the two-year period prior to the Kennedy assassination, the Secret Service had investigated 1,372 cases, with 167 resulting in arrests or convictions and 91 designated unsolved. In 1966, a special committee of government experts found that threats against the president had more than doubled following the assassination of Kennedy. The number of dangerous people grew from 1,400 to 1,800 in less than 2 years. Individuals on a dangerous person list were the biggest security problem. The list had been increasing year by year at a rate of 10 a month and included more than 100 U.S. defectors who disappeared in the communist countries. More than 100 telephone calls have been intercepted in a single night, and in the period of 65 to 66, nearly a dozen intruders have been apprehended on the White House grounds. More alarming was the discovery that people have been found carrying guns near the White House or in crowds Johnson had been preparing to pass through. By 1968, the number of Secret Service agents had increased to about 760. That's a result of the stark increase in threats to the president's life. And like other presidents, Johnson was the victim of copycat threats. Many of Johnson's threateners made associations between him and his predecessor. In December 1963, a month after the Kennedy assassination, James Francis Burns, an unemployed kitchen worker, visited William Johnston, staff assistant to the contact division of the Veterans Administration. Burns told Johnston if he didn't get satisfaction on his claim for a revision of his undesirable discharge, he'd go to Washington and pull an Oswald and get satisfaction one way or another. He was arrested shortly after that and charged with threatening the president. During that same month, the Secret Service arrested 19-year-old Cuban immigrant Omar Padilla in New York City for threatening to assassinate the president. Johnson was planning to visit the city for the funeral of former New York governor and U.S. Senator Herbert Lehman. Padilla told co-workers at a Manhattan graving plant that President Kennedy had been asking for it when he was assassinated, and that Oswald's act was successful because of the lack of security. So he told his co-workers he's going to shoot LBJ. But the Secret Service was taking no chances following the criticisms they received after JFK was killed. During his 2.5-hour trip to New York to attend the funeral, Johnson was guarded by 5,000 officers. The contingent of protectors included Secret Service agents, FBI personnel, uniformed police, and plainclothes police officers. Policemen were posted on rooftops within a mile radius of the venue. And despite the heavy security, a spokesman for the New York City Police Department told the reporters, somebody wanted to get the president. They could have done it. There's no way to stop a determined assassin. It was the other means of assassination we were worried about. Somebody could have tossed a hand grenade into the car. There's just too much to watch. Well, on December 7th, 1963, acting on a tip, police visited Padilla's place of work and found a makeshift target range in an 8th-floor stockroom. There were 19 holes in a plywood and copper-plated target. Police and Secret Service agents arrested Padilla later that day at his home and found a .22 caliber rifle in his bedroom and 50 shells. Now, Padilla, who insisted his remark to his co-workers only a joke, was charged with firing a firearm in a public place and breaking a law that made it illegal for an alien to own a rifle without a permit. The next year, Secret Service investigated other possible sniper plots with links to Kennedy's assassination. In October 64, LBJ was campaigning in Buffalo, New York. Agents received a tip-off about a man who made assassination plans. When agents arrived at his workplace, they observed a rifle lying on the ledge of a window overlooking a street below, which was on the presidential motorcade route. When agents searched him, they found a single cartridge in his pocket. He told the agents he was a brigadier general and a Minuteman, and he only needed one bullet to do the job. He was arrested and eventually locked up in a mental hospital. Secret Service took as equally serious the threat made by 29-year-old former mental patient Michael Von Kramer. Kramer had a bad conduct discharge from the Marine Corps and threatened to kill Johnson at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City in August of 64. He sent letters to President Johnson from New Orleans and Philadelphia. One letter he claimed he was with Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas when President Kennedy was assassinated. Agents checked and found out he was actually in D.C. at the time. On March 12, 1964, Kramer wrote to FBI Director Hoover and said, "I warn you, for in August in Atlantic City, Lyndon B. Johnson will follow Kennedy to the grave." He said, "I'll kill him and it ain't a thing you or the Secret Service can do about it." The letter was traced to Kramer after another threatening letter he wrote in the San Francisco City Jail was intercepted by guards on April 1st. Kramer had been arrested on March 20 for burglary and forgery and given a six-month sentence. April 22nd, Kramer was visited in the San Francisco jail by Secret Service agents. He told him if he hadn't been in jail, he'd have gone to Atlantic City in August to kill Johnson. After undergoing psychiatric treatment at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri, Kramer was held to be sane and sentenced to 5 years in prison. You know, a lot of threateners actually accused the president of being behind JFK's assassination. 58-year-old Everett De Harpot sent a letter to the White House in 65 in which he stated Johnson killed John F. Kennedy. "I made arrangements to keep my mother away from radio and TV because I'm going to kill that dirty skunk." 36-year-old ex-convict Walter Daniel Hendrickson had been paroled from Sing Sing in New York in 56 and subsequently been convicted of burglary, grand larceny, and assault, serving prison sentences in Columbus, Ohio, Elmira, New York, and California. He'd become obsessed with the JFK assassination, mailed a letter in April of 65 threatening Johnson's life. His letter stated, "It's just to inform you that your time will come. I'll do a better job than Oswald and will succeed in escaping." Well, the the Secret Service issued an all-points bulletin for Hendrickson's arrest and described him as armed and dangerous. In July of 65, Hendrickson's name was seen by Amarillo police who had him in custody for stealing a rental car in New York. LBJ had been in New York at the time the car was stolen. They contacted the Secret Service that interviewed and then arrested the would-be assassin. Hendrickson pled guilty and was given a 3-year prison sentence for threatening President Johnson. Next year, two further JFK assassination copycat threats were investigated by the Secret Service. On November 14, 1965, 31-year-old Billy Ray Pursley of Somersville, Georgia, was charged with threatening President Johnson. Pursley told the store clerk who sold him a rifle, which was the same type used in the Kennedy assassination, "Do you know why I want this? I'm going to kill LBJ." Clerk called the FBI and Pursley was arrested. He is found guilty, given an 18-month suspended prison sentence and placed on probation for 3 years. In March of 66, 27-year-old Air Force veteran Oswald S. Peck called the FBI and said he's going to kill Johnson and two Cubans and put him up to it. He also challenged the FBI to find him before he carried out his threat. Well, FBI agents thought Peck's first and last name may in some bizarre way have been connected to would-be assassin to Kennedy's killer. Pick was the surname of Lee Harvey Oswald's half-brother. Pick was tracked down and arrested as he was about to board a Washington, D.C. bound train. He pled guilty in federal court and was given a 5-year prison sentence. Well, according to James Rowley, LBJ actually faced a greater threat than those directed against former presidents. Secret Service has become concerned about the rise and crescendo of national militancy and confrontation, instances of the preachment of assassination and violent revolution. The militancy of the dissident groups in our midst will increase in fervor. The questioning of all authority and the frequency of attempts at the disruption of our authority are going to continue, and this has generated greater propensity for attacks on our leaders. Well, Johnson's efforts to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act attracted threats from race hate groups, but he also faced threats from black militants. One such threat was made by black militant Robert Watts. Watts participated in a discussion group dealing with police brutality at a Dubois Club's meeting. He allegedly made a statement that he would refuse induction into the armed forces if they ever made me carry a rifle. The first person I would want to have in my sights is LBJ. Next day, he's arrested by Secret Service agents for threatening the life of the president. He was found guilty, but the Supreme Court reversed his conviction. Court ruled that only true threats are made outside the First Amendment. That Watts' statement was a kind of crude offensive method of stating a political opposition to the president. Well, while Johnson was certainly a well-hated individual, another president who faced potential assassination was Richard Nixon. Andrew Brimmer had been a Nixon stalker. Following the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy in June of 68, the Secret Service was burdened with additional protective duties. Congress passed legislation charging the agency with protecting all major candidates for the presidency and vice presidency. And then extra work, of course, took a toll on the agents. In fact, one agent died of a heart attack while making advance arrangements for a candidate. Others were attacked by anti-war demonstrators. A doctor who'd been assigned to accompany George Wallace's vice presidential candidate, Curtis LeMay, to Vietnam, described some agents on LeMay's detail as suffering from combat fatigue. And the Secret Service was on heightened alert when Richard Nixon took the oath of office January 20th, 1969. During the inaugural parade, rocks were thrown at Nixon's limo, and police made numerous arrests as his detail struggled to keep anti-Vietnam demonstrators from disrupting the ceremonies. In fact, throughout Nixon's presidency, the Secret Service feared radical groups who tried to harm the president. Now, Nixon was no stranger to the Secret Service. He'd been given protection by the agency when he served as Eisenhower's vice president. And during his 8 years in that office, he'd received numerous threats. And on one occasion, within seconds of losing his life. Now, that close call occurred when Nixon went on a goodwill tour to South America. In fact, in April of 1958, Secret Service Chief Bauman tried and failed to dissuade Nixon from making a trip. He said it was like talking into a barrel. Bauman's fears originated with a tip he'd received that communist agents had hired a student demonstrator to take a shot at Nixon in Caracas, Venezuela. But the Secret Service couldn't find any definitive proof that it was a real threat. Nixon's last leg of the South American journey was, in fact, Caracas. And throughout his tour, the vice president had been confronted by protesters inspired by the rhetoric of anti-American communists. In Lima, Peru, a heckler had thrown a rock that grazed Nixon's throat and hit Agent Jack Sherwood in the face, breaking a tooth. In Caracas, the danger escalated as protesters gathered along Nixon's motorcade route. The crowd was angry because the U.S. had given visas to depose dictator Marcos Perez Jimenez and his security chief, Pedro Estrada. U.S. government also imposed quotas on oil, Venezuela's chief export. Vice President Nixon and his wife Patricia were in separate limos during the drive from the airport to the center of the capital, where they were confronted by protesters whom local law enforcement officers, they were unwilling to control. Violent demonstrators surrounded the presidential limousine. According to General Robert Cushman, an executive assistant to Nixon, when we got into town, a truck was driven out of a side street right in front of the convoy with the vice president in it and stopped. Then the driver ran away. And out of the side streets came pouring his mob with bricks and guns and clubs, and they went to war on the automobiles with the people in them. They were going to kill them. A steady stream of rocks and human spit and bottles rained down on the cars, but Secret Service agents prevented the crowd from reaching into the cars and pulling the Nixons out. Nixon's car was stalled for 12 minutes as the agents fought to protect him. Agents Sherwood and Rodham pulled their pistols out as the windscreen of the car began to crack. Demonstrators rocked the car from side to side as they tried to overturn it. As one agent said, if you'd been inside that car with us and heard the crowd and saw their faces, you'd have had no doubts they meant to get their hands on Nixon and tear him to pieces. Nixon Party is finally saved by a contingent of Venezuelan soldiers who plowed a path through the crowd, allowing the motorcade to continue its journey. Instead of heading to the National Pantheon, where he was due to lay a wreath at the tomb of Simon Bolivar, Nixon was taken to the American Embassy. Troops in Puerto Rico put on alert in case the VP had to be evacuated. Nixon cut short his visit after lunching with Venezuela's junta and President Larrazabal. His motorcade crossed the heart of Caracas along the same route where the mob stayed their attack the previous day. This time it was protected by soldiers and police equipped with machine guns and automatic rifles packed into trucks and cars along the route. Hundreds of soldiers even surrounded the airport. While the U.S. blamed Russia for inciting the riots, government officials determined Radio Moscow's broadcast not only incited violence against the U.S., but instructed Soviet agents in South America to induce riotous demonstrations against Nixon. Bauman said Nixon had been very nearly killed that day. For his part, Nixon said he had been saved from assassination only because of 12 Secret Service agents that used their bare hands to protect him from the mob. July 1958, 8 of the agents got the Treasury Department's Exceptional Civilian Service Award. The other 4 agents got gold medals at simultaneous ceremonies in the cities where they were assigned. I can only say, according to Nixon, that had it not been for them, there's a very good chance Mrs. Nixon and I would not be able to be with you on this occasion. The second major threat to VP Nixon's life occurred when he visited Moscow in 1959. According to 2 Secret Service agents, Nixon was exposed to intense levels of radiation at the U.S. ambassador's mansion where he slept during his visit. The dosimeter showed a reading of 18 and was climbing rapidly, according to one agent. I couldn't believe my eyes or the dosimeter. When I tested the ambassador's bedroom, it went off the scale. The radiation disappeared after the agent's concerns were made known to the Russians. Well, the Soviets dreaded the possibility Nixon would defeat his rival John Kennedy for the presidency, according to Anatole Golitsyn, a high-ranking KGB major who defected to the West. In fact, they had a contingency plan to kill him, to be carried out if he'd been elected. Well, another known serious threat to Nixon before he became president occurred in early 63, one day before the former vice president was due to visit Dallas, Texas. The threat came from the man who would assassinate Kennedy. According to Marina Oswald, her husband, hero worship Cuban director Fidel Castro, and he'd been angry at Nixon when the former VP gave a speech April 20th, 1963, in which he called for the toppling of Castro and the ouster of the Russians from Cuba. After reading accounts of the speech the next day, Oswald was said to put a pistol in his pocket and said, "Nixon's coming to town, I'm going to take a look." Well, taking that as a threat, Marina Oswald asked her husband to follow her into a bedroom, then ran out and braced the door closed to lock him inside. She warned him if he didn't agree to stay home, she'd tell police about an assassination attempt he made 10 days earlier against right-wing extremist and former Army Major General Edwin Walker. Oswald was missed, and the walk was unharmed. After Oswald agreed not to stalk Nixon, she made him give her the pistol and all his clothes except his underwear. She said to tuck the pistol under a mattress. But since her father was senior KGB, you have to wonder how much of what she said could be believed. Well, on this note, we've come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, we'll be talking about... Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.